from WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And this is Second Opinion Live. Glad to be with you today for this radio and webcast edition of Second Opinion Live. We are in holiday mode. It is great to have you here. Switching gears from pets to food on Second Opinion Live. We spend a lot of time in this country talking about food and weight. Many of us constantly looking for a new diet or workout, especially this time of year, or really kind of planning for January. Usually lasts about 48 hours or so. But we believe certain things to be true about what we eat and how we eat it. You know, so it's better to eat several small meals a day than fewer large ones, right? Eating before bed will make us gain weight. We have to drink 8 glasses of water a day. Is any of that true? Today, it's another edition of Second Opinion Live's Food, Fact, or Fiction. Joining us in studio is someone you know well if you watch Second Opinion. Dr. Lou Papa is a primary care physician with the University of Rochester Medical Center for the University of Rochester Center for Primary Care's Olson Medical Group, and also a professor of clinical medicine. Dr. Papa, you guys have such long titles, I could never get through them without tripping up.
Yeah, you didn't finish it.
No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Good thing we're on radio, because I couldn't even fit it on a screen, though, if you're watching on the webcast. It's all of those things. Dr. Papa's here. You know Dr. Lou. And Dr. Steve Cook's here as well. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital at UR Medicine. He's also the associate director for the Institute for Healthy Childhood Weight for the American Academy of Pediatrics. One breath, got through all of this.
Awesome. Steve. You got it all in there. sponsors will be pleased. Thank you.
Second Opinion is a national public television show produced by WXXI Public Broadcasting and the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York. And today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series. So you can watch this program on the web at secondopinion-tv.org. And you can participate in today's conversation by calling us at 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. You can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP, 2NDOP. Doctors Papa and Cook will be answering your questions throughout the hour. So we welcome the calls and tweets. And thank you to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It's through their generous support that we can provide you with valuable health information. Thank you to our public radio and television supporters who help make shows like this possible. Let's get started. Tryptophan is a real thing, I think. But how much of it is there actually in turkey, and does it really make you tired? Dr. Papa, turkey itself makes you fall asleep after Thanksgiving, yes or no?
Well, I think people fall asleep after Thanksgiving for a lot of reasons. It's a long, productive day. You're eating large meals. A lot of the blood gets shunted, so you tend to get sleepy. Tryptophan is a real thing. How much of it is in turkey can make you sleepy, it's debatable. But I think there's a lot of factors that occur on Thanksgiving Day that just make you sleepy. Just talking for long periods of time to family members alone can make you drowsy.
Well, true or fact, true, alcohol is a sedative, right?
Well, yes, that's a very correct. Good point. There's usually a fair amount of that flowing as well. Good point.
Okay, what would you say about tryptophan, Steve?
I totally agree with Lou. It's one of those things that we know it's in the food system, but if you take the whole day in totality, there's so much going on. I know a lot of families are up late cooking the nights before, too, so you're not getting as much rest as you should, which we know is a hugely important factor related to weight. So getting to sleep at a decent time, getting the right amount of sleep is really important. And then all the excitement of the day.
Is it worse for your health to eat a lot of food and then sleep? You know, whether you're eating a big meal at dinner and then sleeping, eating a big Thanksgiving meal and then sleeping, is that going to make you retain weight anymore, Steve?
I don't know that we know that data per se, like taking a nap. We know that, having meals at night and around bedtime or staying up late and having another meal, we see higher rates of weight gain. And it's tough to tease out how much of that is just extra calories versus you ate something and then your metabolism slowed right down to sleep. It's really tough to tease it out. It's not necessarily clear, and it's confounded. It's confused by the fact that it may be actually an extra meal.
And in a lot of adults, a lot of their additional unintended calories tend to occur at the end of the day. The bad thing about eating at night is you can get more heartburn. So if you eat too late before you go to bed, you can trigger more heartburn. But there's a lot of your worst behavior, some of your bad calories, especially in adults, tend to occur in the evening when you've been busy, you ate late, you know, so you're bulking all your calories at the end of the day.
All right, so you can trigger more heartburn. I think of a family member who has GERD, for example,
right.
And is it even worse for them if you've got GERD to eat more late right before bed?
We usually tell patients that have, you know, so there's two different things. There's heartburn, which is we all get, you know. I think everybody gets heartburn on Thanksgiving, you know, because you just eat so much. GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease, is a chronic condition that you have chronic acid exposure to your esophagus. So if you're more prone to that, there's certain things that make that worse, certain foods, and especially large meals or large meals before you go to bed. Because you lie down, your esophagus is at the same level as your stomach. The acid can just spill right into the esophagus.
Okay. Dr. Cook, you want to add to that?
It's something that even kids experience, too. So you can't forget about that. If you eat right before bed, sometimes kids who have asthma, if they have some component of reflux, even mild, it's not full-blown GERD, but asthma flares up as well, too. And one of the first things we'll tell parents if we're worried about for reflux is raise the head of their bed and, you know, make sure they don't eat as well.
Okay.
Right,
well,
right before bed.
How about a fact or fiction follow-up on similar lines? We just talked about eating later. Fact or fiction, working out in the morning is more effective for your body than working out before bed. Fact or fiction?
It's interesting. There actually was a study that found that individuals that work out later in the day actually have more efficient exercise and burn more calories in adults, which is very interesting. I think for most people, when they wake up in the morning, when that's when they're lowest, and that's the theory is that you have more of a catecholamine drive when you first wake up in the morning. That's when most people have their heart attacks and their strokes.
More of their drive. What kind of a drive?
Catecholamine drive. So catecholamines are the things that kind of get you up and going. That's the thing that, you know,
your adrenaline.
Right,
your
thank epinephrine. You. Your adrenaline. The adrenaline drive is the old term that gets you going in the morning. So you have this big spike in the morning, and that's the theory why some heart attacks and strokes occur in the morning. So mounting exercise on top of that theoretically may improve the efficiency of your exercise. But I don't think it's exactly clear. There are some studies that show that individuals that push their exercise routine to the end of the day actually have a more efficient exercise routine.
Dr. Cook?
Well, we've actually seen some data in kids showing that having gym, having physical activity before lunch, kids actually eat better during lunch and stuff. So the activity component is really tough to tease out. There's some suggestion that if you do exercise in the morning, your metabolism may be a little more efficient for the first part of the day. And that's really tough to tease out in some of these studies. I would hope that people are getting their exercise any part
I was
of
just
going to
say, yeah, my guess say, is doctors are not right. going to complain.
Just, I don't care when you exercise. Just exercise. You know?
Exactly.
That's, you know, people just don't move enough. So it's there's worrying about which one will burn more calories is literally like, you know, sand, you know, a grain of sand on the beach. The key thing is to get your exercise in.
And just the other night, I have a friend on Twitter said something that really resonated with me. She said, it was like 10:30. She said, just set the alarm for a 5:30 wake up to go work out. And I imagine the only waking up workout that I'll actually be doing is hitting the snooze button, hitting the snooze button, hitting the snooze button. We've all been there where we want to get up early. We want to work out early. I love doing it when I can, but often I'm working so late. If I'm working till midnight or 1 in the morning, I don't feel like I've got the energy. So fact or fiction, if I'm up till midnight, I want what's better for my body, and I'm going to get up at 5:45 and work out, or should I just sleep more? What's better for the body?
Oh, boy.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, I
finally stumped Lou Papa.
Well,
somebody
think
write this down.
I think, oh, no, I can make something up. No, I think what's important is a lot of it comes down to time management. Because when I speak to patients, it's very rare that people have absolutely no time. There's usually some time that they're watching television or, you know, doing something that's a little less productive. I'm not saying you have to be absolutely productive throughout the day. You should have, you know, an hour of just wasted time if you want. But I think there's always some efficiency. I don't think it has to be an either-or type thing. The key thing is you have to build it into your schedule, and you have to make it a priority.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really important. And on a one-time episode, it's tough to tease that out. If you had this habitual pattern of being up late, that's going to be really bad for you, not getting enough sleep and adequate sleep. And if you were getting the exercise some other time of the day, that would be fine. But the short sleep in that case would be, you know, detrimental, would not be good for you.
Sure. So, and so here's a follow-up fact or fiction to that. I'm somebody who suffers from migraines. And fact or fiction, sleep deficit is linked to migraine.
For some patients, absolutely.
It can act. Definitely can trigger. Yeah, definitely can trigger.
There's different triggers for everybody, so it's not all the same. But clearly, people that have migraine headaches or any recurrent chronic pain syndrome, sleep deprivation is a bad thing for most of them. It really makes it either the threshold gets lowered a little bit, so you're more likely to have more attacks, or it's more difficult to control. So that's you definitely see that.
Your colleague from the Headache Center was on the program last year talking about triggers and how difficult it is because there probably are food triggers, but it's so hard to eliminate enough variables to be sure that, oh, for you it's avocado, for me it's pineapple,
right.
For him it's chocolate. She said really what it comes down to is hormones, which is why women get migraines three times as much as men, sleep deprivation, And there was a third one, but I was too tired. And,
and you had a headache. Yeah. You couldn't remember.
But harder, you know, harder to determine food, easier to say sleep deficit, hormones, oh, stress, right. You know, right. All contributing to migraines. So we're talking to Drs. Cook and Papa, and if you want to contribute a fact or fiction question, if you've been arguing with a friend or a family member about who's right or wrong about a certain medical subject, this is your chance to get clarity and maybe finally win an argument. You can call 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's turn now to a subject that a lot of people have been asking about recently, which is food labeled organic, especially around this time of year. People are looking for, you know, different meats, organic versus not. Fact or fiction, organic food, better for you. Dun, dun,
dun. Define better.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I always have a problem with that because organic food tends to be more expensive. And for a lot of people who have lower income, it's hard enough to get the lower income population to get healthy food produce. But to add the extra layer and saying, well, organic may or may not be better for you. It may taste better, but I don't think there's any definitive data that it is better for you.
It really is tough. I mean, the big area that the focus has been is pesticides, is GMOs, and some of these additives or other products that the food gets contaminated with. And then the second level of processed foods. Are they all coming from organically produced processed foods? But the reality is that an organic juicy juice box or a non-organic is still going to be 120 calories of a liquid sugar that your body's going to take up way too rapidly and turn into fat, whether it's organic or not.
Are you concerned that parents will see an organic label on, like a juicy juice box, that kind of a thing, and think that's a green light, that becomes a health product?
I am very concerned about that because it's happening way too often. The food industry is way too much out there to sell their product and do whatever it takes to sell them, regardless of claims.
Their goal is to get you to eat their food and as much of it as possible.
They're pretty good at that, yeah. Too.
So, I mean, that's a great point that Steve makes, is that you still have to watch the calories.
You do.
Even if it's organic, and that's a big concern. That's a very good point.
Fact or fiction on another food, and when it comes to hot dogs, the National Hot Dog Eating Contest is the most horrifying thing in the world. Fact or fiction?
I can't even believe that's a sport.
It's pretty scary to watch.
I don't want to offend anybody, but I can't. But that's a sport. I mean, that's like a competition. It's amazing to me.
It defies many bounds of the human body it's just incredible to watch
Would you advise don't try that at home?
It's definitely an activity I'd rather not.
It makes Thanksgiving look like you're just nibbling.
It's not a form of exercise at all, no.
No, unless you count vomiting.
But on the subject of meat, though, the WHO had a lot to say about meat recently, right. And I want to hit this a little bit. They said, among other things, they said processed meats such as hot dogs, some bacon, can be carcinogens, and specifically stating that processed meat could be a cause of colorectal cancer. Is that a fact now? Are we accepting colorectal cancer can be linked to processed meats?
That particular research group of the WHO is their kind of research cancer group, and they tend to be a little bit more aggressive. Let's be honest. Does anybody really think that bacon and hot dogs are health food? I mean, nobody ever thought that. The data that they looked at is they looked at a number of different studies, better studies, and there's a little bit better evidence for processed meats than for meats in general. And it looks like across the board, processed meats, they feel are carcinogenic because they may increase the risk by about 18% for cancer. So meats, they said about 17%. So in general, they're a more plant-based diet is better. It's not to say that you could never eat a hot dog again. The reality is they're looking at individuals that eat about 50 grams of processed meat a day. That's about two strips of bacon every day. That would raise your risk about 18%. An average male, 50-year-old male, risk for colorectal cancer is about 6%. That means you lower your risk by avoiding bacon by 1%. So you always have to put everything in scope on the individual.
But that's still one out of 100 people.
Right.
It is.
That's not nothing.
It is. Right. No, it's not. It's not. But what I'm saying is you have to look at your individual risk. So if you have a hot dog once a year, the likelihood that that's going to raise your risk to any substantial degree is still pretty low. It depends on what's the exception in the rule. Is the base of your diet hot dogs and bacon? That could be a problem.
Yeah, could be, you think.
Right. Yeah. But if the base of your diet is mostly plant-based food, you have an occasional hot dog, that's probably not much to worry about.
And that's the other thing with energy. Whenever you see studies like this, you want to know what it is they're comparing against. Right. So if there's people who are having diets that have more than the average amount of processed meats in them. If they're being compared to people who have very little processed meats, healthier food, it's what's displaced in the diet. And then it's your individual risk. If there's a family risk of colon cancer, that's going to elevate your risk more. And that's the hard part of the statistics is, yeah, it's 1 in 100, but I can't tell you which one patient that is.
Right. All right, so colorectal cancer then, fact or fiction, there is a smoking gun food to be worried about. Is there a single food that is more likely to cause colorectal cancer?
A single food?
Yeah.
No. I mean, the biggest risks when you look at your overall risk for colorectal cancer is if you have a strong family history, if you have a history of an inflammatory bowel condition, so ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease that involves your colon. Those are probably the biggest factors. An unhealthy diet, a diet that tends to be low in fiber and low in plant products, high in processed meats, does increase your risk, but those other factors are much larger risk factors.
Yeah, there's no single food, but it's kind of that global healthy lifestyle approach that it's really important.
At least it sounds like if we can eat more plant-based, we should try to do that.
Well, that's the nice thing about this is that you could look at all the different diseases, but pretty much all of the diseases like the idea of a plant-based diet. There's no disease out there that says, don't eat a plant-based diet, you know, unless it's flatulence. You know, that's about the only thing that may increase with your plant-based diet. But in general, across the board, that's going to be good for most disease states.
So I remember years ago sitting on the morning desk with Doug Emblidge, and Doug said, one day someone's going to come out with a study that even blueberries are bad for you. He said he feels like everything. And Doug always says, even moderation in moderation. But what Lou is saying here, Dr. Papa says, we haven't found anything that really indicts a plant-based diet.
Right, right. And you got to remember, a plant-based diet is varied. I mean, Doug's right in some respects. I get really tired of the superfood idea. You know, there's this food mongering type thing where there's the bad food of the year, and then there's always, and I hate the term superfood. There is no superfood. You have to have this balanced diet.
All right, well then, fact or fiction. Quinoa is a superfood.
It is probably this year.
It was kale last year,
yeah, right.
I think.
And it was blueberries the year before that. Right. Tell that to Doug.
But you're not believing in superfoods.
No, I think that's very misleading to the public for the same reason that organic food is misleading. You got to have a healthier diet. It's got to be balanced across the board.
Yeah, but it's really...
But quinoa is good for you.
Well, the one joke I like to say is read labels and don't eat any food you can't pronounce except quinoa. Because, you know...
Where do you get these
monosodium glutamate. A dietitian told me that one. But,
that's really good.
But all these, processed items within the foods, it's really difficult to tell. Back to the meats piece, one thing that they've seen in previous studies with some meats is also how it's prepared. Mm-hmm. So a lot of barbecued foods, we know that barbecued, grilled, actually the way that changes some of the proteins and amines, that may be part of the trigger related to the cancer risk. Mm-hmm. So, again, they're probably seeing people who are eating a lot more foods that are prepared in a barbecue style, as opposed to, not that fried is great, but baked or, in some other fashion. So there's a couple mechanisms, but it's scary. There are environmental factors in our lives that predispose us to chronic conditions and conditions such as cancer that, we just can't put our finger on.
When it comes to how food is prepared, then, this is a good shift to our next set of questions, because you're talking about how meat is prepared. Fact or fiction? We've heard people get concerned that even when they make a smoothie at home, how it's prepared might lessen the benefit of what they're drinking or what they're ingesting. So, for example, you have a smoothie with some kale, some carrot, an apple, a banana, and some juice. And fact or fiction? I've heard people say, I'm concerned that the actual blending of it takes out some of the nutrients.
I don't know that it takes out the nutrients, but blending is just a form of digestion. You eat that kale without blending it, you chew it, that's part of the blending and digestion. Going into your stomach, acid, enzymes break it down. That's all part of digestion. So when you mechanically break something up, you've sped up that process. So then you speed up how fast the sugars, the fats, whatever, are going to be absorbed. I don't think there's any evidence shows that nutrients are lost, vitamins are lost. But it's, if you have a 300-calorie smoothie, as opposed to eating 300 calories of fruit and vegetable, it'll take you a lot longer probably to eat it as a solid food product, and it gets taken up more slowly, and your body can handle it and process it, in a more healthy fashion, as opposed to just converting it to like a fat that gets stored.
The juicing thing is interesting because a lot of that will end up extracting the juice, and you're leaving behind all this fiber, which is beneficial. So I wonder about that. The whole foods, we always talk about the whole foods. There's a reason why we have whole foods. And I think that's one of the things about juicing I don't understand is you're removing that juice, but you're leaving all that fiber behind, which has benefit to you.
I think for someone like me, I don't love kale. You know, which again makes me persona non grata in some circles. I know kale's very popular, but kale hides in smoothies. You know, you can put kale in a smoothie and not know it's there. And I feel like I'm getting that kale. And I don't feel bad about it. I don't turn it into a chip, you know. Kale chips are okay, but I imagine
it's,
they're not.
It's all about preparation. I mean, that's one of the beauties of growing up Italian. An Italian can make anything taste good. For God's sakes, they eat tripe. I mean, exactly. An Italian could make the leg of this chair taste better. So it's all about you know, I'm a little biased, obviously, but it's all about preparation.
But not everyone's Italian, okay?
Yeah, I don't have that. I understand. You'll have to stick with quinoa then.
Exactly.
He can't even say it.
Exactly.
Are you anti-smoothie, you know, for some of those reasons then?
The thing I worry about, and I imagine Steve will say the same thing, is that somehow it's felt that it's healthier, and I just worry that it's going to be another source of additional calories rather than replacing calories. That's the thing I worry about.
That is interesting because I try to make one meal a day, a smoothie, 2 or 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. But I'm not talking about I'm going to have breakfast and then a smoothie.
Right.
Now, sometimes I'm actually a little hungrier, and probably because when you're drinking something, you're probably not as fulfilled. Mm-hmm. As when you eat the solid food, but I try to limit that to being the meal. And if I can do that, that's okay. You're not opposed to?
It really depends on the calories. Right. It's all calories. So I mean, you know, the most natural of smoothies, if it's ice and fruits and vegetables, then it's great. But if you add some other thickener, or yogurt, or sugar, or something like that, it's extra
orange
calories.
Orange juice is what I'm using.
So more liquid calories, orange juice. I mean, it's. What's the total calories and what's the end game? I mean, are you doing it to try to just have more variety?
I want more fruits and vegetables.
Well, that's a good way to get it. It's probably better to eat your fruits and vegetables and drink them, I always say. You know, so one serving of a 100% fruit juice is about what we recommend, fruit or vegetable. So you have one of those and you're like, wow, I'm getting three servings. No, yeah, you're getting three servings, but we would prefer that you really eat them because you're losing these nutrients, you're losing the fiber, you're losing other components that's in the whole food.
I'm changing the name of the show to Buzzkill.
I'm just following Lou's lead.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's the whole, I don't know, you can't, you know, our nutrition has evolved over millions of years, you know, and I don't think you can really kind of fast track that evolution, you know, and that's what we do. We do that with our nutrition. We're constantly looking for the magic food or the quick way.
We try to cheat.
Right. You look at the Mediterranean diet. That's one of my favorite diets, of course. It's very well studied. But a big component of the Mediterranean diet and why it's successful is those individuals sit down to their meals. They eat them slowly. It becomes a social event. There's a lot more around it than just eating the food and getting it into you quickly. And I think that's part of it. It gets back to the exercise thing. You know, there's no way to get you see these commercials for super exercise. Burn your 800, you know, pounds of fat in you know, 6 minutes on this machine. It just doesn't work. The work has to be put in.
I think that is such an important point, though, because we do rush meals in this country, and much more so than our European friends and friends around the world, and that is certainly one of the impacts. Okay, then fact or fiction, juice cleanses remove all the toxins.
Oh, my God. I'm glad he asked that. Yeah,
hold back, Dr.
Yeah,
Papa.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's go into alchemy mode. No, that doesn't work. That does not work. And I don't know where that came from. Some of that can be dangerous in some respects because it's just not a healthy nutritional approach. And I don't know. I don't even know where the whole idea of the cleanse came from.
You know, it's been the concept. Detoxing has been a concept within the diet field for years. I mean, there's actually not really like journal articles, but there's a number of stories of stars in the 40s and 50s doing all kinds of things for weight loss. One thing Marilyn Monroe historically supposedly did was get tapeworms to keep her weight down. So
I never heard that story.
I mean, the concept of a cleanse is essentially a cathartic. I mean, you're taking all this fruit and vegetable and getting a lot of fiber in this case, not much of solid materials, and through it goes. So, you know, do you clean yourself out? Yeah. If you need a colonoscopy prep, maybe that's okay. But for most days, yeah, really not worth it. And I do get concerned because I see not just, you know, it's something adults do. I see parents ask about it for kids, which is something I absolutely recommend not doing. It's
parents asking about kids cleansing?
Oh, yeah. I do a cleanse. I do a 10-day detox. I was going to have my son do it as well, too. I said, really?
Probably the best approach is not to get the toxins in the first place. You know, and that's what it all boils down to. It boils down to kind of a healthier lifestyle and making it a daily routine rather than this idea of some cleanse that you do every 30 days.
Yeah, that's another important point because I've heard people say, well, I'm not eating well, but, you know, next week I'm just going to do a cleanse and sort of get back to zero. and Dr. Yeah, Papa gets right. this eye tick.
Yeah, well, some of it can be dangerous, especially for individuals who have a lot of medical problems or if they're diabetic and they're on insulin. It can get very, very scary. And it's it doesn't make any metabolic sense. I mean, there's nothing to really back that up.
All right, let me get to the phones. Patrick in the city of Rochester, first up on Second Opinion Live. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yes. Now, this is only anecdotal. This is not scientific. But I have heard, it has been heard, that the best thing for a diet is a full-length mirror. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Patrick.
That's, yeah, well.
Brought to you by People Magazine here, I guess. I don't know. Apologize for saying that. But but that's a huge concern in our country because, you know, where body image and weight has evolved in this country, it's always been a big concern. I know I've talked to you about it before, but of all the things we stigmatize people about, obesity is the one that's still, you know, highly endorsed almost in terms of shaming people, stigmatizing people because of obesity.
There's a difference, by the way, and I'm trying to just get inside listeners' heads. There's a difference between what Dr. Cook is saying and then saying that every person, every woman has to be a size zero. That is not what I'm hearing.
No, correct.
But you're saying that obesity is stigmatized because it's a big weight concern. It's a big health concern.
It's people who have obesity, if we can use people first language, are stigmatized systematically in the educational setting, employment setting, personal relationships, in the healthcare setting. We as providers are some of the worst in terms of what we assume of these patients and these individuals. We think they're stupid, they're lazy, they're slow, they're unintelligent. So we put all kinds of subliminal as well as overt biases on these people in every setting of life. And we even see it in children.
Do you have to resist some of that? I mean, are you conscious of it?
I try to. I go to a national obesity research meeting every year. And 2 years ago, they did a survey of the audience of obesity researchers. And they did a survey that has implicit and explicit bias. And so group of obesity researchers, explicit bias, overt, wasn't very common. Implicit bias was still found there within this study. So yes, we still experience this. And we experience it across all systems at an individual level and on a group level.
Dr. Pop, you want to weigh in?
I think part of it is, you know, I in some respects, I'd like to think I'm a little bit more sensitive. I have family members that struggle with this, and so I try to be aware of it with my patients as much as I can. And I think some of it comes down to we as providers, we don't have a lot of tools that really can quickly and efficiently solve that issue. I mean, it would be nice if, you know, if obesity was treated as a chronic disease the same way diabetes is. And, you know, there's behaviors that are involved to take care of it. You know, if you're a diabetic and you don't take your insulin, your disease is going to be worse. We don't have a simple solution for obesity where we just give a pill and we know that that's going to consistently and safely keep your weight off without any complications down the road.
Well, I've seen even presidential candidates endorse pills that are supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's a big
thing. You're talking about politicians, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, they lie?
No, they're untruthful.
Those are big. A pill that will make you lose weight. Yeah. Fiction.
Well, yes. There are pills that will make you lose weight. I mean, you know, I mean, the question that comes down to is, again, you need sustained weight loss. You know, the problem is once you stop taking those pills, you know, you'll gain the weight back. And the problem with a lot of these pills is has consistently been long-term safety concerns that have popped up with all these pills. So the quick fix in a form of a pill is not there. It's always for those people who believe in that concept of the jump starting.
All right, let me do this. If you're waiting on the phones, we're coming to you. So Tim Newark, we're coming to you right after this break. We've got comments coming in online on Twitter. This is Second Opinion Live, and Dr. Lou Papa is here. He's a primary care physician with the University of Rochester Center for Primary Care's Olson Medical Group and a professor of clinical medicine. And Steve Cook is here. Dr. Cook is an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital at UR Medicine and the associate director for the Institute for Healthy Childhood Weight for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Second Opinion here, National Public Television show. It's produced by WXXI Broadcasting here in Rochester. Hope you're either listening or following us live online on the website. So let's get a short break in and more of your questions, fact or fiction, Second Opinion Live next. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. First hour, we're looking at the Paris Climate Talks with a local panel that is interested in local events, trying to create some solidarity around the world for new climate standards. Then second hour, well, you've heard of Yelp. What is People? A Yelp for for neighbors? Is that even legal? Our social media experts will explain that and more. Talk with you Monday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, presenting NPR's From the Top with Christopher O'Reilly and RPO Music Director Ward Stair, Sunday, January 17th. Tickets available at rpo.org. And Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2016 Honda Fit. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Second Opinion Live on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. SecondOpinion-TV.org if you want to watch the program right now on our webcast, and you can call the program now with your questions on food-based fact or fiction. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Let's get down to Newark, and this is Tim. Go ahead, Tim.
Tom?
Oh, Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Unless there's a Tim in Newark. But,
well, I think it's you, Tom. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, hi, guys. Now, this question I have right now is, this is an argument I've had with some people, and my understanding is that GMOs, you know, they're pretty much a natural occurring evolutionary type of thing that's just been speeded up, you know, natural selection, all that stuff. Now, a lot of people seem to think there's some kind of Frankenfood. But, you know, my whole thing is that they're, you know, this is just selective breeding as opposed to transgenic modification. Now, is there a difference between those two, technically?
Well, I think that's where the debate lies. The World Health Organization and a lot of respected scientific organizations have come out and said that there really isn't any harm and there's no difference in GMOs compared to regular crops, just because of exactly what you're saying. I think the concern is the transparency for some individuals in understanding what foods are GMO or not, if they want to make that personal choice. But from I agree with you. From what I have seen in any reputable scientific evaluation, there's no data to support that there's a concern.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big concern. It's really tough to tease out the data, and it's not really as simple as a GMO is a GMO. It's something truly transgenic, something accelerated, some altered. And I think part of it, too, is what happens with these. So it's one thing to have a crop that's more resistant to a certain pesticide, and then you can spray more pesticides to kill more more insects or other organisms. So it's, are we making the food really healthier? Are we making it more resistant to certain changes? Are we making crops that can grow in different climates? You know, they all technically can fall under GMO, but some actually may have potential harms, and we can't just assume that it's safe. But it's tough to tease that out, and it takes really good research to dig into that. And if an organization isn't transparent, that raises even more red flags.
Now, my argument, though, is partially an example I use would be corn. You know, however many years ago, corn was basically, you know, a small, let's just say the size of a grain of rice. And through, you know, selectively breeding the corn, picking the more robust crops and planting them over and over and over and over again, over time, it's turned into the corn we have today. Same as with apples.
Right.
But that's a GMO.
Right. That is an example of a GMO, but I think you also have the potential for plants that are engineered to resist certain types of chemicals or other things, which, you know, probably goes beyond that, and it's just not clear.
Right. Okay, that's what I kind of meant by the more robust.
Right.
You know, they were able to breed more effectively. Survival was a bit of, so to speak, for, you know, okay, so the transgenic thing is more of a, uh, mutation type thing or a controlled mutation. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm long away from genetics, and it's changed a hundredfold. All you know is that, and this is not just kind of a pat answer. I think the debate is a healthy debate. It's the source of our food. Right now, is there any evidence that they're harmful? Based on the data that's available, it doesn't look like there's evidence that they're harmful. The thing that's, I think, makes this worse is the lack of transparency. That I think being transparent about it, they would probably alleviate a lot of their problems if they were much more transparent about it.
I think that's well said. And to Dr. Cook's point, more research is certainly coming on it, and that'll be a good thing. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free on Second Opinion Live, 844-295-8255. An email from Bruce. He says, when it comes to food advice, fact or fiction, listening to Dr. Oz is bad for your health.
Amen, brother.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example. That is basically kind of a Costco version of medical information that's not healthy for you. And it basically kind of, large bulk buying, because a lot of the information that he ends up putting out there is just not proper.
So. Yeah, it's really, I mean, there have been a number of concerns from professionals in the healthcare setting that he goes way too over the edge, making claims that don't exist. I mean, he's prior to him becoming Dr. Oz that we knew, the gentleman was a brilliant surgeon,
yes.
Had patents on certain techniques. So he's not unintelligent, but I don't know if it's the intoxication of the starlight or whatever that he is making outrageous claims on things that don't work. I had a fortunate experience being in D.C. at the time he was doing his Senate testimony and seeing how he kind of really got raked over the coals. It doesn't do anyone in the healthcare system that good. And he's not the only physician or provider or scientist who's misquoted information, but he's gone so far in some directions that people are taking that. And then it interferes with true patient-provider communication to have a meaningful dialogue about something important, especially if you have to now, go dig up information and refute what Dr. Oz is proposing.
Food-based fact or fiction, and a question from Twitter. 2NDOP is the hashtag, 2NDOP, and here's the question, fact or fiction, certain foods and dyes can exacerbate autism.
Thanks, Lou.
sounds like a child question.
Sounds like a child question. Thanks, Lou. So one of the difficult things with autism is when you've seen one case of autism, you've seen one case of autism. Mm-hmm. Autism is such a varied condition and is truly on a spectrum. The early research that was related to, gut-related processes and gluten, a number of those studies actually have been refuted. One of the original ones from England actually was entirely retracted. There's been actually research here in Rochester that has looked at the gluten-free diet, casein-free diets, seen no difference. And one of the fascinating things in seeing some of those results and talking with the team that did the study is it was so difficult to truly find gluten-free food because a number of food items were labeled as gluten-free. And then when the dietary team went to the manufacturers and contacted them and asked them how the food was made, some were not gluten-free or they couldn't guarantee that. So that being a big confounder. The component of dyes and stuff is very difficult to tease out because these are in food products or other products that may have other things. So it's difficult to tease out, was it red dye number 4 that made my child's autism worse? Well, did you cut back on, just sugars and other foods that we know, sugar intake very rapidly does kind of alter your body's metabolism a little bit and can alter behavior a little bit too. So what do you really mean by exacerbating autism? I don't think we really have data that shows that. We actually have very good controlled research data that doesn't support gluten-free diet, casein-free diet. More research is needed to be done, but it's not nearly at this point of, something that we have to really endorse highly.
Okay. To the phones we go, and this is Laura in Clifton Springs. Next up, go ahead, Laura.
Hi, I have a question. I'm a dancer. I dance about 20 hours a week, and I'm a person who eats what they crave, and I eat 3 eggs every morning for breakfast, and my mom, who is a medical professional, says that I shouldn't because it's bad for my kidneys, and I was wondering your opinion on that.
I guess the her concern, I guess, for the kidneys is the protein load, because
right.
there's some data that if you eat too much protein that, you know, it can affect kidney function. It depends on how much protein you're getting.
Right.
I mean, if that's your main source of protein, it may not be an issue at all. So I think it depends on how much protein you're taking in the day and what percentage of your total calories are from protein.
Exactly. And I think also one area that we're seeing more information coming out that may suggest that having protein as your first meal in the morning metabolically may be better for people from who suffer from obesity and from excess weight. From someone, you know, as active as you, as a dancer, you're burning, you know, thousands of calories. I don't know that that amount of protein in the morning is as much of a problem. But a key thing is making sure you stay well hydrated, because part of your kidney function also depends on your hydration too. So just like cleanses can be dangerous to someone who has maybe diabetes or mild kidney disease, it could exacerbate that. Same thing with extra protein. If you don't know you have the potential, or you're experiencing some kidney problem, which can be asymptomatic, you know, it could potentially exacerbate it. But, you know, just on a routine level, I don't see it being too harmful.
Right. Laura, does that help?
Oh, yes, it does. Thank you. Yeah, I'm vegetarian, so I love eggs.
It's a great source of protein.
Thank you so much.
Just vary your source of protein.
Exactly. Try to get some nuts in there as well.
Thanks for the phone call, Laura. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Hashtag 2NDOP if you're on Twitter and you have a question in our Fact or Fiction food-based Second Opinion Live with Drs. Lou Papa and Steve Cook. And from Twitter, here's another one. Someone on Twitter saying, I have ulcerative colitis. I'm trying a grain-free diet. Fact or fiction, grains are bad for your gut.
Grains are bad for your gut? No, the exact opposite. I mean, you know, a high-fiber diet is good for your gut. I think that's all ties into the gluten
right.
picture.
The question
that's
would be,
what
is the gluten? Someone with ulcerative colitis, you know, an inflammatory bowel disease, they may have certain foods that do exacerbate their symptoms. Right. So the gluten would be part that gets confused in there and maybe exacerbates their symptoms. But the grains alone really aren't going to be that harmful in and of themselves. That said, if she does, you know, appropriately kind of alter her diet and have a good balanced diet, she may notice an improvement in symptoms, and how much of it could be related to gluten versus just intense amount of carbohydrate that her intestine can't handle. That's going to be something that may or may not give her more symptoms.
Okay. With conditions like that, and even getting back to, migraines, for a lot of patients, individual changes in your diet may help your condition, as long as it doesn't throw your overall nutrition out of whack. So if she finds that, you know, or he finds that reducing the amount of grains reduces his bloating or discomfort from that, that's fine, as long as he has a nutritionally replete diet.
On the question of eggs, we just heard a question from Laura in Clifton Springs. Here's a follow-up on the fact or fiction side. Brown eggs and white eggs, one's better than the other.
One is brown, one is white.
That's it. No reason to think anything different or concerned about?
No. I think that gets a lot down to some degree, the organic thing and the natural raised thing. And, you know, eggs are a pretty healthy source of protein.
Okay. On the source
regardless of the green, brown, or orange.
Exactly.
And on the concerns about cholesterol, the new 2015 Dietary Guidelines for Americans said that cholesterol is not a nutrient of concern because cholesterol from food does not cause higher blood cholesterol. And so on the eggs question, you heard Laura bringing it up. A lot of people have asked, you know, avoid eggs, cholesterol. Now what are we hearing? We're back and forth on this.
Right.
You know, fact or fiction on cholesterol, avoid eggs.
Eggs are a very healthy source of protein. You know, again, it's everything in moderation. If you can eat 12 eggs, that's going to be a lot of calories.
May have a little problem there. Might have a little issue there.
Right.
Especially if, I mean, and if you fry them potentially too. I think, you know, there is the components of other fats in the diet. And the thing that we've seen really is with the implementation of nutrition guidelines, what then offsets? So we've seen more carbohydrate come into the diet of Americans when fat recommendations, cholesterol recommendations went down, thinking that just carbohydrates are fine, but we're finding that that's not necessarily the case. So with food and feeding, those are really, really tough studies to do. You can't really objectively measure it like you can blood pressure. And then there's, you know, while you're removing something, what is taking its place? And in a certain level, it may be fine. But in a higher level, in the absence of fat, extra sugar may be a bit more of a problem.
High on sugar. Fact or fiction? There's such a thing as a sugar high.
Sugar high.
Sugar rush?
That's actually been disproven.
It's been disproven as kind of a high or a rush. Right. But there are people who do have the sensitivity within their body's insulin levels. You know, when you release insulin, you're going to release other adrenaline, catecholamines, that you'll see some alteration in behavior. The true sugar high, though, not really sure that it's there. You really have to tease that out between, are they getting sugar with caffeine, perhaps, versus sugar alone. But it, or, not really.
Or think when you think about people that get the sugar high, you're talking mostly about kids. Birthday parties, celebrations,
exactly.
Extra candy. There's other reasons why they're getting excited, because it's what the sugar represents and what it's what social event it's tied to very often.
Exactly.
If you're a parent, you want to avoid sugar late at night because the kids will stay up later?
For the kid, you mean?
Yeah. If a kid is eating sugar later at night,
right.
Fact or fiction, they're likely to stay up later.
I think that gets back to the same
sugar
high thing.
It's the same sugar high thing. It's probably not really anything significant. We don't have really, again, a good way to test that or study that in an efficient way with kids and stuff. The reality is the social interaction that's going around it. If they are watching some funny show and, you know, having a bowl of ice cream with chocolate syrup on it, you know, they're probably just as much awake from the interaction of laughing at some show with their sibling or something like that.
But what if it's something like a piece of fruit, a banana? Are they likely to stay up a little bit later just because any food you eat at all has some sort of a physiological impact on your body?
There's some data showing that proteins actually maybe at night, maybe something that's a little healthier, so maybe some cheese or nuts or something like that before bed may actually be a little bit more relaxing. It's not the tryptophan thing, but it is something that may be of benefit. So, I don't know that there's any data that really supports that part of the question.
Okay. I think it all gets back to the idea of trying to avoid those extra calories later in the day. Everybody gets home from school, gets home from work, they eat their dinner, they sit down in front of the TV, and that's when a lot of extra calories get plied on. So avoiding it in general for your overall calorie intake is good.
All right, fact or fiction, there are certain foods that you eat that will help you burn more calories.
Burn more calories.
Are there any foods that are calorie-burning aids?
If they do, I mean, this has always been touted with, I remember it was celery when I was in medical school.
And grapefruit.
There's some idea that proteins are thermic to some extent, that they burn calories. But the effect is minimal. I mean, in the overall sense of you actually burning calories by getting up and moving. So it's not going to be like this, incinerator effect on your body fat. If there is an effect, and I don't even know if there's any great data that really can consistently and reliably show that, it's probably minimal in its effect.
Didn't this always happen with a certain food that we think does a certain thing, and then we find out you'd have to eat like a colon blow level of the food? I'm thinking of remember SNL? Remember they had to eat 30,000 bowls to equal one bowl of the fiber in a bowl of colon blow?
Exactly. 10 times the fiber of pure twine or something like that.
And so, I don't know, that came to my mind. But so what came to mind for me was in the early 1990s, 60 Minutes did this thing on the red wine revolution.
Yes.
And I think it's resveratrol.
Resveratrol, yeah.
But haven't they found that you'd have to drink like 100 glasses of red wine or something?
This is the problem that happens with a lot of this kind of, food fad stuff, is that there's some basic chemistry that's found, and then assumptions are made based on the basic chemistry that it may be beneficial in another way. And nobody really looks at the degree of effect that you would need to actually attain that.
Or the benefit may be in a more limited population.
Right.
So we know that women, especially women before they've gone into menopause, drinking more than 2 glasses of wine a day actually may increase your risk of breast cancer. The beneficial effect around red wine is of people who have at least one cardiovascular risk factor already. So they already have high cholesterol, high blood pressure. So it's a subgroup that may actually get the benefit. And then it's also, what is the real study that you looked at? Was it Mediterranean population who are eating a Mediterranean diet and a Mediterranean lifestyle, as opposed to, someone who's just home from a stressful day and give me a couple glasses of vino, I'm really tired here. So it's a lot of things that go into it. And the benefit may be a small group, but we generalize it too quickly.
And here's my concern on the other side of that. We're talking about the little things that they'll find in food, and then all of a sudden we have this food fad, as Lou said, that we're excited, red wine, resveratrol, whatever it is. On the opposite side of that, you've got people out there like the food babe, as she's called, or people who have been trying to spread information that scares you. They find something in a food, and
the parts per billion or per trillion, right. I mean, it's such a trace level, but you know, the average person doesn't know the chemistry, so they hear, "Oh my gosh, there's arsenic in something, or there's mercury in something," and you're freaked out about it.
Right.
And you've got people like the food babe out there with no credentials saying, "Look at this chemical, look at this chemical in food, don't eat this," as opposed to knowing the actual breakdown. Fair? Right.
It's true, and I think a lot of it, you have to take it, again, getting back to the whole idea of whole food. Because to make the assumption that it's this single thing that's the magic in an apple is presumptuous. That's like kind of saying, well, you know, Evan, you're a great dad because you have brown eyes. And, you know, it's the same type of thing. It's like picking
disprove
out a single
it,
thing.
Lou.
Right. That's the problem. Exactly.
I know.
You can't really disprove it.
It's
an assumption that's made on a single characteristic.
All right, so we got about a minute left, and I'm going to do my own a fact or fiction right out of my back pocket because I get one question myself this hour before we close. There's a product called Soylent, based on named after Soylent Green, which turned out to be people.
Right.
So fact or fiction, Soylent Green was people. Fact, and that was not nice, even though that was fiction, the film. But there's an actual product called Soylent where they've taken all of the nutrients that you need on a daily basis, the daily diet recommended, et cetera. They've turned it into a powder. And if you buy Soylent, you get a powder and a little paste. And you're supposed to drink Soylent 3 times a day, and it replaces your need to actually eat food. And it makes you kind of gassy, they say, but maybe you're actually getting...
So,
it's become a million-dollar industry.
So I'm going to be like, you know, the kid with the guy that's, you know, the emperor's wearing no clothes. Why? Why would you do that?
Right. This is the opposite of the Mediterranean thing where we're sitting and actually eating, right?
Right. It's, exactly. What is the point of doing... I don't quite understand the point of that.
Right. Well, people in Silicon Valley who invented it said food cost them time and money that they didn't have.
Perfect point.
So that's what they wanted. But
that's what they
know.
Wanted, but that's what we all want. And you can't have everything all the time. And the reality is that, you know, we do need to eat, and we need to be a little wiser in that and not look for the quick fix in any form.
Well, I'm going back to, let's flip it back and say, let's do the anti-soul. Let's do the Mediterranean thing. Let's follow Lou's ancestry. Let's eat longer meals.
That's right.
Let's socialize.
That's right.
Let's cook our own food.
Turn off your phone, cook your own food, make sure it came from the earth. Yes. Sit down and enjoy it.
Turn off your phone, yes.
Yep.
Our thanks to Drs. Papa and Cook on Second Opinion Live. Thank you so much for taking the time for us and our listeners today. Hope you've been watching on our various forums and our various partners. And our thanks to, I'm going through all these pages of script, desperately trying to make sure that I can find, I want to thank all the people involved with this, especially the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, through their generous support that we can do this. Have a great weekend, gentlemen. Thank you. John Andrus, engineer. Thank you, John. I'm Evan Dawson, and thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.